Hey everybody, welcome back to Too Much Future, the show where we play through the Fallout games and talk about them. I'm Cameron.
I'm Michael.
This is Fallout 3, Episode 3. Mm-hmm. We fell right out. Michael, did you know that there is a mod for this game that gets rid of
a mod?
There's one mod for mm-hmm. the game, and it gets rid of all the green in the game and like makes it look have like realistic real life colors.
There's what?
How do you feel about that?
There's green in the game?
Yeah, it's got like a little green wash over everything. Everything's got a green tint. You haven't noticed that?
I mean, yes, I'm being facetious because the game is so brown. Game's so brown, it's Cameron.
Game is extremely brown. But how do you feel about that? How do you feel about a restoration of Fallout 3 to some other color scheme?
I don't care. I do not understand the sort of the mindset of the person who looks at a game and is like, this would be better if I just like removed a tint from things. Like that's not a thing normally that trips me up in the enjoyment of a game. Did you install it?
There are some things that trip you up. I did not install it. I did not.
Okay.
I just saw it on the internet.
I see. There are some things that trip me up, though.
There are things that trip you up, but I bring it up because I was playing the game today, and I was like looking over the horizon, and everything was green and kind of hazy, and there was some weather going on, and I thought, this looks neat. And I thought, why would you want to get rid of this? And I thought, maybe Michael did want to get rid of it, but you don't. So... but that's not what tripped you up, the color scheme. The one thing I know about this play session is that you're all mad about it.
Uh-huh.
It went bad for you.
Yeah, no, it became a real Fallout game.
In that you didn't enjoy playing it?
Yeah, no, it felt like I was playing the old games again, in terms of just the things that were happening to me. But I think... some of it is just like straight up like, yeah, no, this is some good old Fallout jank. And then other parts of it, I think, and we'll talk about this later on, sort of, I think, come from the way that this game is actually different from the older games and sort of how that impacts kind of the artifice of the format of us, you know, kind of doing locations in a certain prescribed order. But yeah, we'll get there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, so in this, I think I said this in the last episode, but if I didn't, just to re-up for everybody, what we're doing in this episode is kind of side questy content. And kind of on accident, we did some main questy content, or at least some portion of main questy content that I didn't realize until I did it, but that's okay. So in this episode, I did it in this order. Tenpenny Tower.
Mm-hmm.
The Power of the Atom,
mm-hmm.
which is a quest in Megaton. It's the disarmament quest. And then Agatha's Song, just a straight up pure side quest. You know, mm-hmm. you go to a location, you get it, and you go do some other stuff, and you come back to that person. What order did you do these in, Michael?
I did Power of the Atom, Tenpenny Tower, and then Agatha's Song.
Okay, so how did Power of the Atom go? I'm assuming this went pretty quick for you.
Oh, it was stupendously quick. So Eleanor wakes up in Megaton, or I don't know, regains conscious, whatever happens to these people when I'm not looking through their eyes. And she goes into Moriarty's saloon and she walks over to the corner and Mr. Burke is there. And Mr. Burke is programmed to like pull you into a conversation when you walk close to him. And somehow throughout the entire last episode, I never walked close enough for him to get triggered in this way. So this happened.
Yeah, you do have to like go in his little room or whatever it is.
Yeah. So he's just like, you know, this guy sitting in the corner with his, you know, fedora on and wearing a suit. And he's got a sneaky, sinister man voice. And he calls me over and says that he's got some work that he wants to do. You know, he needs to do something about Megaton. This place is kind of a relic. It's, you know, the wasteland is moving on. We need to clear it away and make way for the future. And he lets me know that his employer, Mr. Tenpenny, would be willing to pay me very handsomely if I were to take a pulse charge that Mr. Burke has and install it on the undetonated warhead in the center of Megaton and blow up Megaton and kill everyone. Mm-hmm. The responses here are basically, you know, par for the course in terms of like a role-playing game or Fallout where you can, you know, be a good person who refuses outright, or you can be like, well, hold on, maybe you need to pay me more than 500 caps. And then you can also just be like, I would love to blow up this town, please. How this ends up working out for me is because Eleanor has taken recently the Black Widow perk. She has unlocked certain unique dialogue options with certain male NPCs, and in this case, Mr. Burke is one of them. So Eleanor basically flirts with him, you know, calls him like lover or something, and he gets very flustered. You then have two options. You can use like the Black Widow perk to continue, like do the quest, but make him pay you more. And you can say something like, you're going to pay me more than 500 caps, Mr. Burke, and you'll like it. So you can fin dom him. Or you can say something like, you know, but Megaton is where I live and you wouldn't want to hurt me. And that's the one that Eleanor chose. And Mr. Burke was like, oh, of course not. No. I'll have to do some rethinking of my options here. But rest assured, I will send for you soon. And then he gets up and he walks out of his out of the saloon and he disappears. So that's done. Now we still have that atomic bomb. So Eleanor, having accomplished, I guess, dealing with Mr. Burke, she walks down into the pit. And she puts on a Raider Blastmaster helmet that gives her a plus to explosives, and she fixes, like, she defuses the atom bomb, and then, you know, Lucas Sims at some point, the sheriff, he shows up and is like, well, hot damn, you did that. Like, here's your reward and some bottle caps or something. And that was the end of Power of the Atom.
And you get a house, too, right?
Oh, yes, that's right. That's the reward, is I get a house in Megaton.
It's pretty good. You get a robot butler.
Mm-hmm. Named, like, Cogsworth.
Which is, yeah, Cogsworth, which I believe shows up again in Fallout 4.
Yeah.
Not the same Cogsworth, but a Cogsworth. So this is some Bethesda lore building, mm-hmm. I guess. And the very idea, like, the notion that you would get a robot butler here, mm-hmm. when people live in, like, literal radioactive sewer waste, mm-hmm. I don't know, there's something going on here. I also, during this episode recording, just due to the lack of options, ended up taking the equivalent to Black Widow, which is Lady Killer, and which, same, but for men to women. Some real procedural heterosexism going on, mm-hmm. here. Compulsory heterosexuality, algorithmically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't, as far as I know, women can't take Lady Killer and men can't take Black Widow.
No, they cannot.
Unfortunate game. Bad choice. But I kind of did this, Michael.
Mm-hmm.
I went in and I got the Mr. Burke stuff, and actually got that last time that we recorded. But I went in and talked to him again, and he said, well, and I said, all right, fine, I'll do it.
Mm.
Like, you know, you want me to do it so bad, I'll do it. And then I went right outside. I got the detonator thing you're talking about, the little pulse bomb thing. I went outside, and I went and found Lucas Sims, the sheriff. I said, Lucas Sims, Mr. Burke's trying to get me to blow things up. And I know that Mr. Burke works for Mr. Tenpenny. He says that. He says that, mm-hmm. he's got a benefactor or something like that. So we go in there. Lucas Sims confronts him, and he says, you need to get out of town. And Mr. Burke says, okay. And as Lucas Sims turns around to go out the door to lead Mr. Burke out, Mr. Burke pulls out a silenced 10 millimeter pistol and shoots Lucas Sims to death.
Damn.
Yes.
I wish I had known that he carried a silenced 10 millimeter. Eleanor could have stolen that. That would have been useful for me.
It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. And then he just scooted out. He just ran away. So I, of course, you know, you don't want to leave equipment on the ground. So I, you know, repatriated the clothing on Lucas Sims's body and also his weaponry. And then his son ran in. And his son said, hey, you know what? My dad told me he had all kinds of stuff that he wanted to give you if you completed this quest. So when you're done, come talk to me.
Oh, no. Poor kid.
Lucas Sims, or Lucas Sims' son, who is named something. I have it here in front of me. Harden Sims.
Mm-hmm.
He becomes my new quest giver for this. And so Chonk, in his mind, says, I have to go get justice for Lucas Sims. I don't care about this bomb. I don't care about Timpani Tower. I care about justice for Lucas Sims. And you know who is at the tippity-toppity of both the tower and the line of responsibility where the buck stops for the murder for Lucas Sims? It's Mr. Timpani himself.
Mm.
So I hike on out the Timpani Tower with a little bit of hate in my heart. Mm-hmm. And ready to deliver some frontier justice with a baseball bat.
Nice.
I'm assuming you also went out to Timpani Tower at some point.
Yeah, no, right. Like right after this, I wanted to see if I could follow up with Mr. Burke because he disappeared immediately after walking out of the saloon. And I'm like, oh, this is interesting. Is he going to go to Timpani Tower? Is this going to sort of affect what happens there? So Eleanor goes out to Timpani Tower. And do we want to sort of like lay out that whole situation here at the top?
What do you mean?
Oh, just like sort of the what happened when Tonk arrived at Timpani Tower? Like with the hate in his heart, did he just like come in baseball bat blazing, ignoring everything, or did he take his time?
So I was running a little bit down, and as I got to Timpani Tower, there was a ghoul talking on an intercom.
Mm-hmm.
He said, hey, Smoothskin. but basically, I got to overhear a conversation where a ghoul was saying, hey, let me into your armored tower because I have the bottle caps to pay my way in. And the people inside Timpani Tower were saying, hey, I don't want to let you in because you're a ghoul.
Mm-hmm. They keep calling them zombies.
And so the ghoul walked away and I tried to talk to him. He was like, don't talk to me.
Yeah.
And so I had to go back and had to pay a little bit of money to get into Timpani Tower, but I just went right in there. But I did have a goal in mind. Mm-hmm. Now, there's some other quest stuff that can happen before you go do your goal, but I really had one goal in mind here.
Okay, yeah.
How did you get involved here?
Well, so Eleanor comes up on Timpani Tower. She, you know, watches this conversation play out, as you've talked about, with the ghoul Roy Phillips. So one thing just to note that the Bethesda games do that the earlier games didn't is that they sort of consistently give people normal names. We haven't yet run into just a random human named Cosmatron or something, but that is absolutely what would happen in Fallout 1 or 2.
It would be like, I guess there's something great about it because Roy Phillips is the kind of very common name that you might see in Fallout 1 and 2. But also Cosmatron would be his best friend.
Yes.
You're like, oh yeah, just my ally, Cosmatron.
Yep. She overhears all this stuff. She says that she has business with Mr. Timpani and she needs to be let in immediately so she doesn't have to pay to go in. The guard is like, okay, hold on. Also, and if we're going to talk about sort of like procedural rhetoric with regard to gender, from this point forth, anytime I go into Timpani Tower, the guard, like, you have to hit the button on the intercom in order to open the gate. The guard says, all right, keep your panties on. So the game acknowledges, I guess, that I'm playing a woman in that regard. But I go into Timpani Tower, and it seems nice, right? Everyone's kind of hanging out here. And I ask the leader of the guard, whose name is Gustavo, I believe, what's going on with this ghoul situation. And he talks about how there's like a colony of ghouls that lives nearby and they want to live in the tower, but no one wants them to live in Timpani Tower because they're ghouls and they're, you know, gross and dangerous and smell weird and all of this stuff, because like ghouls are a kind of race allegory within the Fallout universe. We've seen this in the first two games, and we see Fallout 3 setting it up right here, like, pretty explicitly to kind of onboard new players. And I told him, well, you get a lot of opportunities to agree with him and his like, ghoul racism, and not a whole lot to sort of talk back to him. So Eleanor, who is, like, very open-minded, or at least thinks of herself as such, doesn't pursue a whole lot in the way of conversation with Gustavo, but, you know, I walk around all of Tenpenny Tower, and I talk to all the named residents, and I kind of get all of their perspectives on the ghouls, because everyone here is, you know, you can ask them, like, what's Tenpenny Tower like, and what are your thoughts on the ghouls? Most of them like living in Tenpenny Tower, unsurprisingly, and most of them are not huge fans of the idea of ghouls moving in. And I do all this, I meet all these people, and then I work my way up to the top of the tower, where I meet Mr. Tenpenny himself, and he has basically nothing to say to me. Mr. Burke isn't here. Mr. Burke has disappeared from the game, so I guess, right, he may show up later in some way that I'm not aware of, but, like, Mr. Burke is just gone. I was wondering...
This also happened to me. Yeah, he's just gone.
Okay.
I don't know.
I'm like, well, okay, what do I do now? I guess I need to, you know, do something about this tower and the ghouls. And I know that the ghouls are living in the train tunnels nearby, so I go out to the train tunnels, and the door's locked. So I can't do anything there. So I have to go back to the tower, and I talk to Gustavo again. And it turns out, like, I need to take the quest from him in order to figure out how to get to the ghouls' colony. So I have to talk to him, and then eventually, basically, I get the option, because he's saying, you know, he wants you to kill the ghouls. That is what he wants you to do. He wants you to go, you shoot them all. And Eleanor had to say, like, I'm going to find a nonviolent solution to your ghoul problem. And then I got the map marker that let me know how to get into the train tunnels in the right way.
Tonk had a little bit of a different thing here.
Mm-hmm.
Tonk just went right up to the very tippy top of the tower.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a guard in the way that said, hey, if you don't have an appointment, you can't get in, because Tonk did not have an appointment. He just had to pay some money to get in.
Mm-hmm.
And the guard was there, and his whole body was selectable in vats to hit with a baseball bat.
Mm-hmm.
Or perhaps a sledgehammer. I think this was actually a sledgehammer at this point. And Tonk did that. And stole all his clothes and all his equipment, and then went out to speak to Mr. Tenpenny. And Mr. Tenpenny gave us all kinds of information that just verified what Tonk was about to do. Mr. Tenpenny says, you know, it took so much work to fortify this tower. Why should I give it to anyone else? He's wielding mm-hmm. a sniper rifle. And I said, well, what are you shooting out there, bud? And he says, oh, just anything. He says, it's the Wasteland Safari. And Tonk comes to the, you know, the morality receptors in Tonk's brain blink off and on like 5 or 8 times.
Uh-huh.
And he just thinks, this person is a bad person. We gotta make the waste good, better. You know, those mole rats need to live their lives out there. Those ghouls need to live their lives out there. And so he just gave a good old smashing, just like a hyper smashing, to old Tenpenny, right in the old noggin.
Mm-hmm.
And here is again another moment of interesting, you know, presentation of the world by the game. Interesting argument being made by the ideology of the game, because the first thing that happened was that I got good karma.
Oh.
It just ding, comes up. And something we haven't talked about, as far as I can remember in the past couple episodes of this, but which is important, is that karma generally had to do with decisions you made in Fallout 1 and 2, or in Fallout 2 at least. Karma had to do with decisions you made, and it was kind of predictable, but there was no information about it in the, like, little log at the bottom. It just kind of happened. And mm-hmm. it generally was attached to other stuff, too. So, for example, the child killer perk, quote-unquote, where if you kill a kid, people are hunting you, and you get bad karma for that, you're a bad person. It has this kind of material relationship to the world. Karma, and so it kind of has to do with, like, the world's perceptions of your actions.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting in Fallout 3 is it's almost like there is some sort of deity somewhere who is judging all of your actions. And even if no one is around to know about them, you're still get judged.
Mm-hmm.
So I got good karma. But here's the thing. This is the other kind of interesting part of the argument. I went back downstairs, prepared to fight my way out of this tower. My Chimpenny Tower quest was going to be over here. Uh-huh. I was going to be done. Tonk wins again.
Yeehaw. Success.
But no one knows that Tenpenny is dead.
Ooh.
You know.
Weekend at Tenpennies.
Yeah. You know, the Schrodinger's Tenpenny. I talked to Gustavo and he gives me these quests. And so I thought, well, gosh, if I've already killed Tenpenny, then getting the ghouls to live here can't be that much harder. And so that is the vibe with which I encountered this quest. But so once you went off and talked to the ghouls, what happened?
We're going to start. I need to flag something here for the viewer listener, because it's not going to become apparent to Michael playing the game for another couple hours. Here is where my troubles start. When you're going down into when you go down to the train tunnels to meet the ghouls, you meet a new enemy type, which is the feral ghoul. Let us just say that the game is doing a thing by having like regular ghouls who are basically people and also like a race allegory, and then feral ghouls who are actually just monsters who will kill you and you can slaughter them with impunity, right? There's a real problem with the representational politics there. And in fact, like one of the things that Roy says when he's hollering at the intercom at Tenpenny Tower is like, you can't tell the difference between me and a feral. You fight a whole bunch of these ghouls, and they're not too hard, but Eleanor is a, you know, gun-based character, and she's got a good amount of ammo at the moment, and in fact, I think even Gustavo maybe, like, either gives you some, or he also sells ammo. So I've got a good reserve of ammunition, but most of the things that you're fighting at this stage in the game aren't using guns. They're animals or creatures, and so you're constantly expending bullets, but never really taking them back in. So I start working through my ammo reserves, taking out all of these ghouls. But it doesn't become a problem yet. It's going to become a huge problem later, because I'm not really thinking. I'm just, you know, no thoughts, head empty. I'm having a great time. And I get down into the train tunnels, and I meet Michael McMaster, or Michael Masters. Mm-hmm. I don't remember exactly his name, but he's another ghoul who,
you know. He's wearing a rad helmet. He's wearing a super cool helmet.
He's wearing like an aviator's helmet or something, or like, mm-hmm. I don't
know. Yeah, like a helicopter pilot. Yeah. It's like almost the one that has like the comms that are built into it. It's a little bit big.
Yeah.
It's great.
And he, you know, sort of stops you and he's like, what are you up to? And you can have a conversation with him. And you can tell him something along the lines of like, you know, like Mr. Tenpenny or Gustavo or whatever, like has sent me all to kill you. And he's like, hey, now, wait a minute. And then Eleanor was like, no, I'm just here to warn you. And so then, you know, Michael lets you in and you can talk to the like two other ghouls who are living down here, one of whom is Roy Phillips and another one who is a woman whose name I don't remember. But you can talk to the ghouls, and it's similar to kind of what happens when you go into Tenpenny Tower. Like, you sort of ask them about their situation and what it's like, and you can also ask them, like, what it's like to be a ghoul. And you learn, like, this is also, like, the game's introduction to what ghouls are, and we establish that I think all three of these characters actually, like, are from the pre-war times, because ghouls are they're functionally immortal. And you know, they come about through radiation poisoning and whatever, and
FEV, presumably.
And FEV, yeah. But then eventually you can find Roy and talk to him, and Roy is Roy has a plan, right? He has a plan for what he's going to do with Tenpenny Tower. He's going to gather up a bunch of feral ghouls and let them in through the basement to, I guess, slaughter everyone in Tenpenny Tower. And that's how he's going to get ghouls into Tenpenny Tower. Eleanor thinks about this, because what is Tenpenny Tower? But really, a kind of vault, right? It's a place where people have set up sort of protective measures, and they're just kind of happy there, living their lives. And sure, they may have some bad opinions, or there may be some, you know, sort of problems with the process by which people are accepted in. But you know, that it's there's nothing wrong in the nuclear wasteland with wanting to put up some walls and keep out critters and things of that nature. So Eleanor says to Roy Phillips, "You know what? I'm gonna find a nonviolent solution to your human problem." And so I wander back to Tenpenny Tower and begin talking to the residents about how they might feel if they were to have ghouls as neighbors. And I talked to just about everyone, and there are a couple of residents that I noticed that I have like a speech option with, like a speech check, I should say. And with every single one of them, it's 100%, because Eleanor has a very high speech skill and she has high charisma. This is a thing she's good at. And so with a couple of these residents, you have the option when they push back, because none of them like the idea of ghouls living in Tenpenny Tower, especially. You basically have the option to just like speech check them and be like, listen, this is happening whether or not you like it. And their response is like, well, OK.
Some of these people, I didn't talk to very many of these people. Mm-hmm. Because as I'll reveal, Tonk approaches very differently. But what I do like is that there's Mr. Chang, I think is his name. Comrade Chang.
Yeah.
Who is basically meant to be like a champagne socialist, right?
Yes.
Like a champagne Maoist.
Yeah.
The idea that like he's hyper privileged, he doesn't like ghouls, he's just as racist as anyone else is, or speciest as anyone else is. But he like wants to get a committee together, mm-hmm. and he like really wants to debate the options.
Did you read his terminal in his room?
No, I didn't.
So you can, he has like a penthouse on the upper floors, and you can like read his computer where he's like keeping his notes. And he talks about how he's like descended from Chairman Chang, who specifically traces his lineage to like the Chinese forces that invaded the United States during the time of the Great War and fallout. Yeah, and he talks about how they need to like, he says something about, you know, like we can both destroy the past and build the future. And he talks about we need to organize the farmers, right, which is a very clear kind of like Maoist shout out. He's a very funny character in that way. And it's also sort of like the most explicitly that this series has up to this point now acknowledged like communism is a thing that existed. I think they called the Chinese the Reds in Fallout 2. But now we have this. The other character who is important here, who really caused me some problems, is this guy named Anthony Ling, who is the proprietor of like the little clothing store on the ground floor of Tenpenny Tower. And so when I went to talk to him about how he might feel about ghouls and being neighbors, the speech check for him that had been 100% for everyone else was, for reasons I do not understand, only 75%. But okay, 75%, that's pretty good options. I fail it. Anthony does not want to have ghoul neighbors. And after that, there's not really a lot I have in the way of dialogue options. Now, I want to pause, actually. And did you talk to Dashwood?
No. Okay. I didn't. I think the only people I talked to were Chang, the two Changs, and then the person who owns the store.
Oh, okay.
Whatever his name was. Yeah. And I just wanted to look at his inventory. Chunk went a really different direction here. So no, I did not.
Okay, so I want to talk about Dashwood for a second. Dashwood is a resident of Tenpenny Tower. His name is Herbert Dashwood, and he's called Daring, like Daring Dashwood. And the idea behind this character is that he was like a wasteland adventurer who was very successful, and he had a ghoul manservant named Argyle who accompanied him on all of his adventures, right? So there's a couple things happening here. One is that the game is importing a style of like pulp adventure fiction that was very common in, you know, the 30s and 40s and 50s. And the game recognizes that very often the main characters, the swaggering adventurer heroes of these stories, would have sidekicks who were other in some way. Very often, you know, if the person is like having adventures in, let's say, Polynesia or something, right, their sidekick is going to be someone who is like native. Right.
Yeah. So like common examples of this are the Lone Ranger in Tonto, mm-hmm. Johnny Quest and whoever his dude was. I can't
remember his name either.
And you'll notice like of the examples, the Green Hornet, who I don't know that character's name either, but had an Asian sidekick. It's common. I'm just not super deep on adventure fiction. Otherwise, I bet I could pull a bunch of other ones. But yeah, as you're saying, Michael, very common pulp trope. Grognak the Barbarian, of course, his ghoul buddy that I just made up.
So the game, on the one hand, understands that it is importing this kind of like cheesy, frankly problematic type of fiction, but its response to that is not to sort of, you know, critically interrogate the racism inherent in the idea of having like a manservant who is racialized. It's more just like, wouldn't it be funny if instead of like an actual racialized person, it was just a ghoul? And yeah.
Johnny Quest's sidekick is named Haji.
Okay.
He also had a monkey, I believe.
Mm-hmm. And here's where this gets even weirder. Dashwood is the one resident of Tenpenny Tower who likes ghouls, because he had a friend who was a ghoul.
Mm-hmm.
So he's like the one person who's just sort of totally on board. Like, yeah, no, I think ghouls are fine people. And I sure miss Argyle, who it's very strongly implied that like Argyle kind of did all the heavy lifting during their adventures. And he maybe left Argyle for dead.
I wonder if we get to see Argyle later. Wouldn't that be cool?
Oh, guess what? Guess what? We do.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Wait, so, in this episode?
Not in this episode, but I know Argyle comes up later because I remember this.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. And I also actually, because we're talking about sort of like the fantasy racism at work here, also, I want to revisit Comrade Chang and just talk a little bit about how I think, like, I do not know exactly how that is supposed to land, right? Him tracing his lineage back to like Chairman Chang. But I think there's something that needs to be interrogated there too, about sort of the way that his communism, his like the sort of like skewering of his Maoism or whatever, also gets collapsed into kind of like, well, he only thinks this because he is either actually descended from or tracing his descent from like Chinese invaders or something. So something to sort of hold in.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the intention there, and it, you know, it always gets weird when we're talking about intention, but I think the way that it's written is meant to be a parody of leftists, right? I think it's meant mm-hmm. to be like, oh, this person who is incredibly, you know, the same champagne socialist stuff I was talking about before, right? Like it's meant to be read as this person is at the top tier of existence in the wasteland, and yet is still attached to this politics that, you know, has pretensions to all the other working class things or underclass, when in fact this person's part of the upper class. But you're exactly right. There's a racialization component to it and a ethnic component to it that just is ignored, or, you know, there's a naturalization of being Chinese and descended from, you know, of Chinese descent, with politics that happens mm-hmm. here, with a particular kind of politics. I mean, it's Red Panic, right?
In
quite explicitly. Well, how did this all end with you? I mean, since you had one holdout, did that mean you could still do it?
So I have one more note actually about Dashwood. He has a computer mm-hmm. in his room too, and this touches back on something I said in the last episode. He has like his write-ups of all of the places he's been in the wasteland, and mostly it's about like brothels that he's been to. But he mentions Megaton, and he mentions Moriarty. He of the Irish accent. And the way he describes Moriarty is like, oh, he's, you know, been sort of like a like scheming little social climber since he arrived in this country when he was a kid. So this is, I mentioned this in the last episode, there's just this like very weird moment where it's like Ireland still exists, I guess, and somehow Moriarty immigrated from there when he was a child after a nuclear war. It's, you don't have to think too much about that. That's not like a point of cultural critique. It's just like, wait, what's happening?
Yeah, there's some kind of, it's almost like, have you seen the cinematic classic Reign of Fire?
Oh, yes, of course.
And he's, so it takes place, I think, in Ireland, right? Or maybe just in England?
It's in like the British Isles, because
they have to go to London in the film. So it's got to be somewhere fairly close. And, but yeah, that movie, Matthew McConaughey is an American, and it establishes that, yeah, they just flew a plane. You're like, the world has been taken over by dragons that prevent flight, and the Americans just took a plane. I mean, it was hard and everyone died, but they just took a plane.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it.
So there's that. I go up and I talk to Mr. Tenpenny, and he tells me, I say, you know, would you be okay with having some ghouls live here in Tenpenny Tower? And he sort of mulls it over, and he's like, you know what? If they can pay, like, on the one hand, so what? But if you can convince, like, certain of my current residents, like that they should have ghouls for neighbors, then I'll allow it. It turns out I've already convinced most of these people, but except for one of them. And I have to, like, find them, and because this is, you know, a Bethesda game and people have schedules and they're constantly walking around, I spend a good amount of time trying to find, like, the one person that I have just missed in talking to everyone. Eventually find them, convince them, go back up and talk to Tenpenny. He has nothing to say to me. Because I didn't convince Anthony Ling, who is my one holdout. At this point, the quest ends. Like, my only other option would be to go back and side with Roy Phillips and let the feral ghouls in. And because Eleanor has sort of made her decision, that's not something she's willing to do. And so we get a classic Fallout moment of a quest just kind of dead ending. And that's where Tenpenny Tower ends for Eleanor.
It is interesting that people say things like Fallout 3 is such a radical break from the previous games because playing them back to back. Not really.
Yeah, no, this like, felt, you know, very much like a Fallout, like an old school Fallout situation.
Yeah, you just can't complete the thing. Sorry.
Or you can't complete it.
You now have one bad option in front of you.
Right, like you can complete it, but it's not the way you wanted to do it, so.
Mm-hmm. Tonk went and talked to the ghouls and thought that their plan sounded perfectly fine. He didn't particularly care for the people who lived in Tenpenny Tower, and they were all mean to him. Like, that's the thing. You only get to call Tonk, you know, some backwater idiot so many times before you get to meet the baseball bat. It's just the fact of the Fallout-iverse. Mm-hmm. And so really weirdly, and I'm sure I'll show this on the in the video where people are watching it, but Tonk walked up to Roy, is that his name?
Mm-hmm.
Walked up to Roy, and he and the woman who lives there were both drinking a Nuka-Cola in the exact same animation, like perfectly sequenced with one another. And it was really weird. And so I had a conversation with them, or just with them. I didn't really talk with any of the other ghouls very much. Just let them in. Another interesting moment of kind of Fallout 1 and 2-ishness here is that if you go down into, first I had to do some, I had to get the key to the basement to let the ghouls into Tenpenny Tower, which is actually kind of hard. So what happens is you talk to the guy who's the captain of the guard, and he says, and I said, hey, can I have the key? And he says, no. You can't have it. I lost it one time and I had to get a new one made, and I never heard the end of it. So obviously there's another copy of the key somewhere. But Tonk did what Tonk historically would do, you know, what his across the country genetic, distant relatives would do. And he just hid behind him and then using his like 15 sneaking skill, just repeatedly tried to pickpocket it off his body until he got it right. And he did, much like in Fallout 1 and 2. So I got down to the basement and the only thing I can see in front of me, I can see all the ghouls like hanging out in the basement in front. And there's a, a terminal in front of me. And I click on it. It says you need 25 science to get into this thing.
The loss of science.
I know. Yeah, exactly. How about that? You know, bite me really in the butt.
Mm-hmm.
And so Tonk thinks, gosh, what am I going to be able to do? And so there are two generators and then there's a science thing. And I like walked around a little bit and tried to figure it out. And I thought, surely there's got to be a way to do this because I'm right here at the end of the quest. And I don't want to have to go like manually kill everyone in Timpani Tower. Because that seems bad. That's not really what Tonk's into. He will create the machinery for that to happen, but doesn't want to do it himself.
Can we pause just a moment?
Mm-hmm.
Because that reminded me, Eleanor in a darker timeline did investigate whether or not she could just murder Anthony Ling and arrange the move in that way. When she shot him in the head a bunch of times, everyone in Tenpenny Tower went hostile. So again, classic Fallout. But continue. Yes,
In true classic Fallout, it would have happened when you failed that speech check.
Yes,
but so I'm like, ah, gosh, and so I look it up. I look on the thing, and I'm like, surely there's got to be a way to do this. And I'm just missing it. I just can't see the other terminal, or there's another thing that I missed in dialogue. And so I look it up, and like I said, very classic Fallout. The two generators that are there, no one tells you this. There's no information. I mean, they explain what the generators are, but it doesn't seem like the kind of thing you can interact with. But you can shoot those generators and blow them up, and that will also open the door.
Oh.
But they don't produce any unique noise when you shoot them. They don't have like a damaged animation or anything like that when you hit them. It literally, they just look like, you know, background info or, you know, background stuff. But you can shoot them and blow them up. So Tonk did that. And then went back outside, and Roy was standing in front of Timpani Tower, and he was like, all right, Smooth Skin, thanks for helping. We'll see you later. And Tonk naively,
mm-hmm.
you know, if there's one way of describing Tonk, it might be that he enters situations naively very often, thought, oh, I'm going to go in here, and all the ghouls are going to be moved in. A+, cool stuff. Tonk goes in and sees a charnel house of horror. It's all these ghouls running around, killing all the people who live in Timpani Tower. And that's bad, of course.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Tonk recognizes that as bad. But what's worse is that the ghouls then aggro him and start trying to kill Tonk. And so he has to run out of there and flee Timpani Tower. So it's given over to feral ghouls now. And seems solved. Honestly, seems good to mm-hmm. me.
Yeah.
Got some experience. Went back to Megaton, went to the bomb, used, I think, repair skill on the bomb, got it ready to go, and got his house. So it all worked out there in the end.
Great.
Yeah, it was fun. Got my own house. And then I went and did the other quest that we were talking about, that mm-hmm. we did for this episode, which is Agatha's Song.
Yes. So Agatha's Song, it's very close to Arifu, where we went in the last episode. It's like very close to the train yards that you have to go to for that mission. As you're walking around those train yards, you can see sort of nearby this like old like rope bridge with wooden planks across like a little ravine or something, and some rocks, and you go across there, and there's like a little shack. It's called Agatha's House, and you go inside. Well, Eleanor goes inside, and she meets a woman named Agatha, a nice elderly lady who I get a lot of like charisma speech options with. I can just sort of like, for whatever reason, I'm just really allowed to smooth talk this old lady. And you learn that Agatha has a like a little radio station, and she plays violin on the radio. And that is how she, like, draws traitors to her, and she, like, plays them music in exchange for supplies and things of that nature. And she also tells us about how she and her husband, and there's no real reason given for this, but she and her husband decided to, like, homestead here and like swear off kind of contact with all other people for some reason, really. And not much to say about that other than that it is what it is, I guess. But yeah, so you learn all this stuff about her, and what Eleanor learned is that Agatha does not like her violin, her homemade violin, very much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the problem, is that it's a homemade violin. Mm-hmm. Which, good luck, buddy.
But luckily, it turns out that Agatha has a lead on where there might be a very high-class violin, a Stradivarius violin, as a matter of fact, because her, I think, great-great-great-grandmother, Hilda, and exactly how this works out, no, it's just great-great, exactly how this works out is sort of confusing to me, but her great-great-grandmother, Hilda, sent some letters to her great-grandmother that explained her. So her great-great-grandmother was also a musician, a violinist, and she had this Stradivarius, the Swall Stradivarius. And in case the player doesn't know what a Stradivarius violin is, which is a real thing in the world, right? In our world, where Jill Stein is president, there are in fact Stradivarius violins. So it's like a weird little like educational moment for the player. But this Stradivarius was taken into Vault 92 by Grandma Hilda. Vault 92 was supposedly dedicated to like the preservation of the arts. So Vault Tech had all of these fine musicians come in. And that's where they were locked away. And now here we are 200 years later, and maybe that violin is still around. Agatha would really appreciate it, maybe, if you went and checked.
Yeah, I got a speech option that was, I wrote it down because it was so funny. She asked if you'll go get it, and I said, I will go get a damn moon rock if you pay me enough. A damn moon rock. But yeah, so we got to do that, and there are a couple steps along the way, because we don't know where Vault 92 is.
Nope, neither does Agatha.
Yeah, and so we got to figure that out. So the way we do that is that we go to the Vault Tech headquarters that's in DC.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't want to talk necessarily right now about, we can talk about the headquarters, but let's not talk about the process to get to the headquarters, which does require a little bit of work, because I think it's going to be better to talk about that and like kind of the design of downtown DC in the next episode. So if y'all want to hear us talk about tunnels and conceptual stuff there, I think we should do that there. But all of that said, we get to Vault Tech, and I actually like the design of this Vault Tech executive, or the Vault Tech corporate headquarters and the executive suites that we end up in here. Pretty linear as far as like stuff goes. It is a Bethesda dungeon in that, mm-hmm. you know, you go in and you got to work your way up. You're working your way up the corporate tower to the top floor. You're fighting robots. There's a couple super mutants I ended up having to fight who were like looting the building. Mm-hmm. And the security system is on. So you got to kind of fight your way through that. Get lasered. Mm-hmm. I got shot by lasers a lot here.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not, I wouldn't say there's too much to say about it other than you just got to navigate your way through it. There's a lot of playing with 3D space in the way that was just impossible with Fallout 1 and 2 being isometric and 2D games. So for example, they're in the second kind of area that you're in, there are all these rooms that you can navigate and kind of sneak through that drop into the floor below them. So, you know, robots aren't good at jumping and things like that. So you can kind of manipulate where the robots are if you want to hide from them or get away from them. But what's cool to me is the top one, the executive suites, where there's a thing called the Master Brain
mm-hmm.
running around. What was your encounter with the Master Brain like?
So I know you said you didn't want to talk about the process of getting here and all that stuff, so I'll keep this as light as possible, but this is very important for understanding exactly why I, like, by this point, I hated this game. And here's the other thing, is I remember playing this game for the first time back in 2008, and I remember getting messed up in the exact same way that I got messed up here, which is to say, I could not figure out how to get to Vault Tech headquarters. Like, I could not do it. It made no sense. The map is really weird. And I blew through all of my ammo, like, trying to fight off super mutants that were chasing me. And then finally I get to friggin' Vault Tech headquarters. So by the time I'm in there, I have, like, no ammo. There are all of these robots around. And, like, I'm just getting slaughtered constantly. I fast travel back to Megaton. No one is selling the type of ammo that I need. I guess maybe because I've bought them out. And that's really the only place I can buy ammo right now other than Tenpenny Tower. And so I actually, yeah, I think I go to Tenpenny Tower. And, like, Gustavo is not selling the ammo that I need. And I don't know how long I have to just, like, sleep for stocks to be replenished. And I also don't know how stocks are replenished.
Wait a week.
Yeah.
I think it's a week.
So I am, like, I'm low on ammo. I am just so frustrated. I'm just, like literally, like, my experience in Vault Tech headquarters by the end is I am, like, quick saving when I get into a room, and then I am just running through hallways trying to figure out, like, where I'm supposed to go next, getting murdered, and then respawning and trying to, like, run as quickly as I can in what I think is the right direction the next time. This ends up being confusing and complicated because in order to open the door to Vault Tech's mainframe, well, there are like three computer terminals in Vault Tech headquarters, and there are like two of them, like they're numbered like 1, 2, and 3. And so on the third floor you find, and you can start the process there by like deactivating the master brain, which is like the sort of like main security system like robot. So you start there and you have to do all three of them. So you start with that, you hit one. I eventually find two, get that one. I cannot find three because it turns out Terminal 3 is on the second floor. So you actually walk past it on your way up to the third floor where Terminals 1 and 2 are. But then
I had the exact same experience. This exact same thing happened.
It's so weird. It's like baffling. In terms of game design, like why they would have done this.
Yeah, especially because there's like the level design is such where each of the corners look out on the mainframe. And so that's where the terminals feel like they should be. And they're not there.
Yeah.
Only one is in the corner thing. So,
yeah.
And then the master brain's like hunching you this whole time. Mm-hmm.
Eventually, I do get the master brain like shut down and I get the door open, and then I'm running by all of these turrets because I don't have a high enough science skill to hack the turret controls and turn those off. But then I get the friggin' vault locations in my Pip-Boy, like, glorious. I love it. Thanks.
You know, on one hand, it's very disappointing to hear mm-hmm. that this happened to you. You know, I have empathy for you. I have sympathy for you. I have all the peace for you. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I've had such a terrible time this whole time that having an encounter where you were able to not get through it with, like, you know, a fun time, and I was able to kind of breeze through it. It feels good this one time.
Well, we're not even done with mine yet, so.
Well, mostly the reason I was able to get through that, and I actually had a much harder time in the next part that we're going to be talking about, but part of the reason that Vault Check wasn't super difficult for me is that I have a lot of explosive skill, and I have like 20 landmines that I got in Minefield. Mm-hmm. And so I was able to defeat the Master Brain by like running into a room and then dropping a bunch of landmines at the like right in front of the door and then closing the door. And so it had to go in front of the door to open it, and then it just blew up. And once you kill, if you don't shut down the Master Brain and you actually destroy it, you can shut down all of the security system in the building by interacting with it. So I was able to kind of like maneuver my way through it. Also important is that robots, for whatever reason, if you get right up in their face and melee them really quickly, they can't shoot you because you're like inside of their hitbox. And so I was able to kind of manipulate that a little bit. But similar deal as you, I get the locations, I go out and I fast travel and get as close to Vault 92 as I can. I go in and I'm ready to mm-hmm. do it. How was your experience at Vault 92?
Well, sort of related to like what was going on with Vault-Tec. And by the way, when I was searching for Vault-Tec, that was when I met the Brotherhood outcasts, right? I managed to get them to kill some super mutants for me.
Oh. I saw them a second time, but it was actually near Vault 92, not near Vault-Tec. So that's interesting, like how many different places they can show up.
Because this is an open world game, because types of characters or types of enemies are going to show up in other types of areas, types of enemies are going to show up in certain types of areas. This happened in Fallout 1. It happened in Fallout 2. But Fallout 2 and Fallout 1, I think, still were structured in such a way that the main quest would keep you away from areas where, like, the enemies were more higher level than you. And we're kind of, in a way, like, playing this game against the grain by, like, I think launching into, like, we are going to do this quest, right? Like, if I were doing Agatha's Song and I were playing this game on my own time, then I would be like, oh, Vault 92, like, that's way up in the north of the map, and I haven't even touched anything up there yet. I'll just, like, you know, check that off my list when I'm actually in that area for a real reason. Because also, it turns out, there are death claws right outside of Vault 92.
Yeah, I've got some footage of me, like, looking looking at whatever that facility of it is near Vault 92, and there's, like, a death claw patrolling back and forth, and I was like, ooh, glad I'm not over there. Glad I'm right here.
And so also, because of my experiences within the city, by this point, I was so frustrated that I actually, I think I did this over the course of maybe 3 or 4 play sessions. And for my last play session, I forgot to hit record in OBS, so I didn't get any of my footage of actually being in Vault 92. But Vault 92 has been opened up. It's a ruined vault, and it is filled with friggin' Mire Lurks. Mm-hmm. And I still don't have any ammo. I still have not replenished those stocks. Like, I do not know how long to wait. I do not know where to get ammo. And I'm like, oh my god, what am I going to do? Let's cheese it. So I still have 2 stealth boys. Kind of a miraculous fashion, I use the first stealth boy and I manage to stealth my way all the way down into the bowels of the vault. So the vault is, like, also partly flooded, and you get some computer terminals that you can read where the people in the vault were talking about, like, oh, there's a structural problem here and blah 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 blah.
Oh, I love the story of this vault. Once you finish saying this, we'll go back and talk about it, but it's very good.
You get, like, one of the terminals that talks about how there's, like, a structural instability and it's going to cause flooding. And obviously that's what's happened, and that's how the Mire Lurks have gotten in. But I stealth in. I go past all of the Mire Lurks. And, of course, the vault is very confusing because it's all ruined and brown and red and samey. But I manage to get down into where the Stradivarius is. I find it down there. And then I have to get out, and it takes me about this long, as long as it takes me to get down to this room where the Stradivarius is, that's about how long the stealth boy lasts. So it's just, like, it's great, right? Like, perfect timing. Stealth boys last, I think, like, 2 minutes of our time. And so I get down there, I get the Stradivarius, and I have one stealth boy left. Then I need to find my way out. Now, the problem is that there are a lot of locked doors here. They're average locks, but Eleanor doesn't have a high enough lock skill to get through them. So I end up getting lost. And I am, like, completely lost. There are all these Mire Lurks around. I have no ammo. And I am just like, oh, God, what am I going to do? So I'm trying to sneak as best as I can without the Mire Lurks getting me. I get up to the top of the vault, and all this time I'm reading kind of the audio logs and stuff about the story for this vault, and I get to the Overseer's office, and I get kind of the last bit of the lore there, and, like, the feeling of this was just so bizarre, right? It's one of those moments where it felt like it's actually kind of cool. There's a stealth boy on the Overseer's desk. right? Just sitting there. And it's almost like, you know, if this were a more contemporary game, I would feel like, oh, does the game sort of like tracking my play style and like dropping items that it knows are suiting my play style or something. But I looked it up and no, like this stealth boy is just normally there. So I get another stealth boy and this allows me to sneak out of Vault 92 with the Stradivarius. I go back to Agatha. I give her her friggin' violin and she's super happy and lets me listen to her radio station.
Yeah, I have developed, I think, over the years, a preternatural capability of navigating Bethesda mm-hmm. RPGs. Just, I think, somewhere inside of me, like, I don't know how to do Division, but I can do this, basically with my eyes closed. And so I never get lost anywhere. And, like, I can look, I don't, and I honestly don't have any explanation for it, but I can look at the like little waypoint and be like, oh yeah, I'm going to have to go in the opposite direction here in order to go there. Like I can just feel it out. I don't know, you know, what has happened in me. Maybe all those years of like, you know, playing Oblivion in college and having nothing else to do, but, and then Fallout 3 actually too. But, that's all to say. So I didn't have any issues like navigating it or anything like that down in here. The issue I had is that I'm a melee character, and Mirelurks are very hard to defeat mm-hmm. as a melee character. Like, you know, they just hit you harder than you can hit them. And so I solved, quote-unquote, the first few by aggroing them and then walking backwards and just dropping mines in front of me. And so as they charge me, they just blow up. Okay, that's great. But there are more Mirelurks in here than there are mines in my inventory. And so I eventually, and I'll show some of this footage, but I eventually end up having to, like, you know, save the game. Because they're not just Mirelurks, but there are Mirelurk mm-hmm. hunters here, too, which are, like, the upgraded, the second tier. And so I would, like, put a mine down and, like, get a grenade in my inventory, go around the corner, throw the grenade, hope that I break its feet, run back over the mine, have the mine hit it, and then shoot it with a laser gun. Like, I couldn't even use my melee weapon because it would kill me in mm-hmm. one or two hits. I'm running very low on stim packs at this point, so I can't even really heal myself. And so it was very much, I actually really liked Vault 92 because it was very much this like, kill a few enemies and then desperately scrounge around for any equipment or any, you know, healing items or food or anything I could stuff in my mouth in order to like get to the next little bit. So it took me a long time. It probably took me a full hour just to get through this, but because of having to just reload so much, but I didn't feel like I was wasting my time or anything. It felt like a pretty thrilling little puzzles mm-hmm. almost. In a way that, like, say, when I had to do that in Fallout 1 and 2, my series of the tools in my toolbox in Fallout 1 and 2 were so limited that it never felt like I had four or five different ways of trying something. Whereas here, you know, I had many different ways of approaching something. Especially because in Fallout 1 and 2, if you don't have a small gun skill, for example, you're just never going to be able to mm-hmm. hit anything. Whereas here, I can use some melee weapons, or I can use some ranged weapons first and just like hammer on the button and shoot them and then switch to a melee weapon and deal more damage when they get close. So that's all I'll say. I eventually get through it, get the Stradivarius like you did. I didn't actually find the Overseer's place, which is interesting. So I never got the final thing of it, but the story of Vault 92, tell me mm-hmm. if this is correct based on you getting the full story, but they took all the arts-based people, basically mm-hmm. in the United States, put them here, and then the vault is built to be maximally annoying.
Yes. Specifically, I don't think it's all just like arts people, it's all specifically musicians.
Yes. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, yeah. It's not just, because there are no, you know, painters or sculptors or anything like that. So in the first little bit of information I got about that is in the Vault Tech headquarters, you can read a thing that says that noise emitters uh-huh. were installed. And you think, huh, musicians and noise emitters, why would they need that? But yeah, I read things that said that the sewage was leaking into the ventilation pipes.
Mm-hmm.
I read one where it just said that like random noises were appearing. Oh, and there was like a minor hum that's happening all the time that they can't figure out where it's coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it seems like it was just meant to, like, drive these people mad.
Well, so, quite literally, what was happening is Vault Tech was testing a kind of mind control. The white noise emitter was a mind control device that was essentially they were making it to trigger subliminal like combat training. So this entire thing, actually, it turns out, right, they collect all these people who are musicians who you assume might have like very keen senses of hearing, and then they install like a like high frequency mind control device that only these people are going to be particularly susceptible to. And so you
that's cool. That's cool writing.
Yeah. And it shows how these games can make something of the vaults and sort of that last minute retcon at the end of Fallout 2, where it's like, oh, all of the vaults were actually a grand social experiment. These games can take that and do like they make little like story dungeons, right? Like they have a little field day with this. And this is also, talking about the first episode, like this is clearly like a BioShock thing, right? Taking all of the people who are the best at a particular skill, locking them in a room, and then having them all go crazy. And because what happens eventually is the people who are being mind controlled, there's actually a really horrible terminal you can read. It's like a diary of one of the musicians. And she's talking about, you know, her first entry is like, oh, I feel so safe here. Like, I'm glad, you know, we're not out where all the bombs are dropping and so on. And we, you know, got together and we had a practice and we played some Haydn or something. And as she has like three entries. And in the second entry, she's complaining about the noise. And then by the third entry, she cannot coherently write. Like, she's making all these typos and all of the words are getting run together. And I think there's actually like a fourth entry that's just her like trying to type help again and again and again.
Just to plug our other show, very similar, Just King Things, our podcast about Stephen King. Give it to Google or go to rangetouch.com to learn more about Just King Things. But it's very similar, that because I also read that diary, to the Stephen King short story in which the protagonist accidentally destroys the minds of everyone on the planet.
Yes, the end of the whole mess from, I believe, Nightmares and Dreamscapes.
Yes, yeah, it is. Yeah. So on Just King Things, we'll get to that in about 5 years.
Yep. So anyway, yeah, like what happened in the vault was the overseer knew about this. There was like a head musician or something. His name was like Professor Malleus. And he didn't know about it, but he discovers it and he gets really upset. But then by this point, like the people in the vault, essentially, like not only have they been like, you know, mind controlled into being soldiers, but then the conditioning stops being effective, right? They can't be controlled and they just like go crazy and slaughter everyone. And that's the end of Vault 92.
Very good. And I did the same thing, got out eventually, took it back to Agatha, and she says, yeah, I'm going to play better music for you. And she commits to playing better music. And it all works out.
Mm-hmm.
So that's great. So next episode, we're going to be doing Galaxy News Radio. We're going to be chasing down our dad. We're back to the main quest. And then the next episode after that, I don't really know yet. We're still working on the plan for it. Michael, do you have anything else you want to add at the end of this episode?
No, I think I covered everything.
Where can they find you on the internet?
You can find me on Twitter at WarrenIsDead.
If you want to know about the other stuff that we do, you can go to rangetouch.com to see all of our other shows, including Game Study Study Buddies, Just King Things, and Sword Coast Coast to Coast, actual play podcast that will be... Actually, it might be over by the time that this episode comes out, but are recently completed, probably. Actual play podcast, actual play show, I guess I should say. If you enjoyed listening to this episode, you can go to patreon.com/rangetouch. The description is down in the, or the link is down in the description below this video. At $3 a month, you can get access to listening to this show as a podcast if you listen to it on YouTube and you'd rather have it as a podcast. And at $5 a month, you get access to all kinds of special bonus stuff that we do every month, including some notes for Game Study Study Buddies, including bonus episodes sometimes of Just King Things, and the monthly podcast that I do with Danny, where we just kind of talk about stuff and have a good old time. So if you enjoy the show and if you enjoy listening to it and if you want us to keep making cool stuff, think about throwing us a cup of coffee every month. You know, if you back us at the $3 amount or the $5 amount. That's a fairly small amount of money, and we appreciate everyone who gives that amount of money. But everyone giving a little bit of money equals to quite a bit of money that we can use for all kinds of different things. Fallout 3 as a show is made possible by buying Michael a computer.
Yeah. Yeah, that's how I have like footage for this one.
How about that? Yeah. So, you know, there's a material thing, and we also use the Patreon money to do things like pay for the art for the episodes, to play for musical themes, to buy new equipment for audio and stuff like that. So it's not, you know, and also I guess I put some of it into a cannon and launch it into the air every month. That's a part of it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, who would?
But yeah. But yeah, so that's the end of this episode. In 2 weeks, we will be back. We'll be talking about Galaxy News Radio. Michael, you want to take us out?
Until next time, war never changes, but Fallout sure does. Everything changed.